Welcome back, everybody, once again for another episode of Confident ROI. The one show you can confidently listen to, get a real return on your investment each and every time. Whether you work in a business, on a business, or with other businesses, from the man who's done all three, Alex Ferovia. Hey, Alex.
Good morning, Paul.
How are you today?
I'm doing great, but I realized my video's not on, huh?
Well, you know, it's early. It's early in the day here. It's early in our day here. We're only at 9:30 on the West Coast here.
Well, I think I fixed it.
I think you did. So we have a lot to talk about today. Oh, my goodness, you gave me some of the show notes. I know you had another guest here who had a crisis and couldn't make it, so we're going to do our normal shtick here back and forth and take a look at the day's news and see if we can't figure out some of the trends and, what do we call them, ideas, interesting ideas percolating up through the atmosphere here.
Yeah, I think what I want to talk about today, I think, is the new sales front that is really going to change business for a long time to come. It used to be you had to sell customers. Now you got to sell something else.
Yeah, I'm curious to talk about that because I think in many ways sales is being reframed across the board. I'll give you an example of that. We had somebody on another one of our shows last year who really said, maybe we don't need one salesman. This is going to sound awful. Maybe we need three salespeople. We need somebody who is the farmer, who's out, you know, tilling the soil and just talking to people. Then we need the classic, you know, closer, the person who's there to make sure that the deal gets done. And then you need somebody to nurture it later and to keep going back and dealing with them. And that used to be one person. You know, when I carried a bag many, many years ago as a kid, I had to go find them, I had to go close them, and I had to make sure I stayed in touch with them. Maybe that's three different functions these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see the rise of the inside and the outside salesperson.
But, exactly.
But there's also that function of how do you find talent, nurture that talent, and retain that talent. And that's not necessarily one person, or is it one department? Is it one size fits all?
Exactly. For example, on another one of our shows, they said maybe that tilling the soil, that initial contact, is done through artificial intelligence. Certainly done on the internet these days. They're, you know, what they used to call the inside salesperson, someone calling back saying, I see you were on our website. I see you downloaded our white paper. You know, what can we do to help you? I think that's kind of an offensive way to do it. I'll just tell you a quick story, and I'll share the name of the company in case they're listening here. They might want to contact me and apologize. Salesforce, the giant Salesforce. A year ago, I thought, you know, maybe I'll look at Salesforce again. And I went and looked at their website. And honest to God, within seconds, I'm getting phone calls, I'm getting emails, I'm getting text messages, I'm getting everything under the sun. And it continued for a week. And finally, I answered one of the phone calls, and I said, stop already. I was just looking. Well, we're just trying to see how we can help you. No, you're not. You're trying to see if I'm a hot lead or a cold lead. Where do I go in the sales funnel? I said, stop it. Can't I just look for a second? And you can't, you know, the minute you start, and that's why so many people are hesitant to raise their hands because they know they're going to be overwhelmed the minute they do.
It's a double-edged sword, but it's, I've been looking for I need a pair of boots here for the wintertime now.
Sure.
And, I like these Echo ones and they went on sale, but, okay. And now like every website I go to, there are those shoes and they're on sale.
Yeah. Right.
But now I'm also using that as leverage. Like, well, wait, go a little more. And then, maybe I'll buy it. Cause you know, they got the data that says, okay, he's not buying. And I put him in the cart. And I've got him all the way there.
And don't they often? Yes.
There's some analyst there like, oh man, he was in the cart.
$1 more. He'll buy. Yeah.
Maybe 20.
I think that there is a coming era where, you know, those initial contacts are going to be done somehow through the internet. And then, because Forrester did a famous study a number of years ago, it's quoted all the time, that by the time people buy, they have already been searching and sniffing around, and they've narrowed it down to 70% of their decision-making has already been done by the time they contact you. Rightly or wrongly, they decided that Alex is the guy, based on his video, based on his recommendations, based on his cool website, based on all the stuff that comes up when you search his name. He may not be the guy, but they've decided, based on all that, you know, sniffing around, that you're the one they should talk to. And And they don't want to talk to anybody until they've done that. That's what people don't get. Don't overwhelm me the minute I appear in your radar.
Well, yeah, it's a challenge because I love this thing on Firefox. It uses a web browser, and it mm-hmm. recommends articles for
okay.
me. And a couple weeks ago, I took my wife into the jeweler to get her engagement ring and wedding ring fixed because her first horse broke her finger. And it never got back healed to the point where her original wedding ring and engagement ring would
okay.
fit. So she's gone a couple years now, sans the ring.
Which is always a little dangerous when they get used to taking the ring off and, you know
kind
of looks
like... on the other foot, you know, how far you think this would go, right?
Yeah, exactly. Honey, you haven't been wearing the wedding ring in a couple years. You know.
And so we finally went down and we were getting it sized and... And then on Monday morning, we went on a Saturday. On Monday morning, I was looking at, I opened up my web browser and the articles. And the third article was sponsored on how to select a wedding ring.
See, yeah.
Or an engagement ring.
They're watching. And, they know.
Well, I had a client that sold shoes. They sold trendy tennis shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed me how if you search one of these shoes that they're selling, they can see, then they can track whether or not you went into their store or someone else's store.
Wow.
Within a certain period of time.
I don't know if I like that or not. I mean, I appreciate that they're trying to recommend and help me find what I'm looking for. But this idea of, I'm offended, not just that they know what I'm doing, but that they overwhelm you with, they try and immediately do it. Now, on the reverse, I've seen heard statistics that say people do finally raise their hand. And people don't get back to them for a week. You know, they want it, when they finally do, they want instant answers. But until then, it's in their hands. Leave them alone until they're ready to talk to you. You can tempt them with ideas and suggestions and tips. Click here and do all this stuff. But I'm a big believer. Don't overwhelm them until they're ready.
Well, you were mentioning AI and how to connect with people earlier.
Right.
My daughter is interested in a robot for Christmas.
Of course.
Right?
She doesn't want a puppy. She wants a robot.
You know, and she's not questioning the whole Santa Claus thing. But, I mean, she's 10. It's like, just thinks there's a, you know, anyways.
Anyway,
so
she still thinks there's a jolly little man that's going to make a robot and bring it to her. Yeah.
We've been looking at them, and they're actually kind of cool. And we're watching one, there's 5 robots video on YouTube. And this one out of Japan was downright scary because it, you know, it had the eyes and everything, and it would help you order stuff online and turn on the music, but the girl was singing a song and the robot starts playing the actual song. And then it got really scary when the lady was doing yoga and the robot said, you know, you haven't called your mom in a while.
Oh, ouch.
And I know you're mad at her, but
it's distributor of guilt.
I hadn't heard anything about AI and guilt, but that's a weapon of mass destruction.
And, should a robot really look like a person, or should it look like something else? I mean, why do we have to? Is it anthropomorphic?
Well, they're focusing on the eyes. So they had different variations, kind of a small body and it kind of like an ET neck and head.
Mm-hmm.
But almost all of them had a real emphasis on the eyes in terms of big eyes, and they were watching you. And we do react to eyes. Like if there's a poster of eyes, you know, on a wall, we're more likely to behave.
Interesting.
Better. They've done studies on human behavior, but the eyes are how they're humanizing them.
That's interesting. Well, I don't know if I want them to be human or not. Well, let's do a tip of the hat today to the late Lou King, who I don't think most of us ever heard of. I certainly never did. But you pointed out that this man was a innovator in a way, another intrusive way that now has become commonplace. Talk about Lou King.
Well, I remember as a kid watching golf tournaments and seeing the Amana hat. I think Raymond Floyd wore one, and I didn't know what it was, but I thought it was golf related.
Yeah,
but it turns out This was the guy who got the whole thing of golfers selling their forehead, and now race car drivers do it, and so many
sell their whole body now everywhere. They've got it anywhere they can put a corporate logo that gets seen. They'll do it.
Well, the PGA Tour now has guidelines on how many logos can be present because a certain John Daly has pushed the limit in how much real estate he sold. But,
and in the beginning, for, at least from the article you forwarded me, they fought it. They would try and if Liu Qing got a golfer to wear his Amana Appliances hat, they immediately tried to find ways to shoot him from behind or from the side that wouldn't display that logo because they didn't think they were getting paid for this is our broadcast and your ad.
Well, and they had other advertisers, right?
Yeah,
and that was their real estate they were selling. So yeah, they tried to do it for years. They now laugh about it by the fact of, yeah, we gave up a long time ago and it doesn't matter. But they were very affronted, like, how could you wear this? How could you sully this? It was okay for the TV company to sell advertising, but it wasn't but the ironic thing was they were only paying them $50 a weekend.
That's what I couldn't believe it. For $50, these guys would sell out that cheaply. For $50, the network is selling it for $50,000 and they're trying to slip in an ad for $50 here.
Well, yeah, maybe it was a little less back then.
Whatever. But
yeah, the sales were a lot different. And
well, what a genius. So Liu Qing, thank you for sticking logos in everybody's face all over the place.
It wasn't just in golf. He had one of the sole logos appearing in the NFL for 3 years all by himself.
Where did it appear in the NFL? Where did they?
He gave the stocking caps to the Minnesota Vikings.
Ah, love the Vikings.
They still played outside.
Yeah.
He just gave it to them. He gave them to him for 3 years. He didn't pay them.
Well, that's sheer genius just to get people to
what Nike pays now, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Per year. But just giving it to him. And
so let me ask you a question, and it goes back to the nature of what you're talking about here, kind of in an overall theme. Does it really work to stick your name in front of everybody's face, whether it's you search for something and now the search engine instantly displays those ads, constant reminder you're looking for that shoe. Everywhere you look, somebody's got a logo. Everywhere you listen, there's somebody inserting an ad. We're going to insert an ad in a little while here. I don't know that this idea of constant bombardment of advertising works anymore. I think people just are trained to tune it out.
There's recognition, but being able to stand out in an economy of 320 million people, mm-hmm. I think if we look at reality TV, they weren't paying those people initially a lot to be on reality TV.
No, almost nothing, The Real Housewives, we've talked to some of them here in Orange County, they got next to nothing in the beginning, yeah.
But now a lot of them have been able to monetize. I mean, look at the Kardashians. I mean, not just one of them. A number of them are quite wealthy because it gave them a platform, one they could connect with people, and then they could sell products.
Sell appearances, sell all sorts of crazy stuff, yeah.
I mean, Rush Limbaugh started his own products. I mean, he started selling children's books and iced tea because he had trouble with sponsors. And so he developed his own products and marketed them directly. And I think that's in such a cluttered world now. How can, because people want to feel connected. That's what we don't have anymore. We're not connected to our neighborhood anymore. True. We don't live in the same one for 50 years.
No.
We're all moved around. So how do we feel connected? And I think some people really feel like they know people they follow on Instagram.
Well, and no question about it, or on TV or on a podcast or whatever. There's a connection you build as you listen to somebody and watch them over time, the YouTube stars, all that stuff prove it. But I guess my point is, here's maybe this is more specific. When I go to YouTube and I want to search for a video on how to change a tire, I don't want to see toilet paper ads stuck in my face. I'm immediately going, stop, stop, stop. When I go to read an article about Liu Qing, I don't want to see something in there about hemorrhoid ads. Stop, stop, stop. It has nothing to do with what I'm searching for. And I can't believe that really worked because I'm angry at that product for intruding into trying to force their way into what I was watching here.
But it's also free. You're getting videos for free, encyclopedic videos for free. But my daughter.
But I look at that as almost a right now. You know, I mean, that's the problem with news and everything. I'm supposed to be free. I'm not supposed to pay for this.
Now we can put in a part number and how to install it. You know, I was having a problem with my car and resetting the tire pressure gauge, right?
Yes, right.
Everyone
Me
has,
too.
You know, that annoying light. And I just put in a couple things and there's a video on how to do it.
Oh my
free.
Goodness. Oh my goodness. I was just going to go pay to have that done. You just gave me a good idea. Well, I guess my point is, so as they get better, I don't mind if you insert an ad that has something to do with what I'm searching for. If the tire ad came up before the tire pressure gauge and said, here's some tips on how to keep your air pressure up or something, maybe that has some relationship to what I'm searching for. But when it has nothing, this idea of just constantly intruding in front of you, I think creates a reverse reaction of stay away.
Sure. But then a lot of services, I think YouTube offers it, like, hey, if you want our service instead of the free service, you can pay and we won't bombard you with commercial.
And
Stitcher does that. And so it's economics. Are you willing to pay not to have your defenses up?
I want it all. I want free stuff now, and I don't want anybody to intrude upon me.
That's a funny thing, because that gets into one of the root causes that was identified in our main topic today on dealing with full employment.
Yeah.
Is that there isn't a lot of give, and employers don't want to give on compensation on working terms and benefits.
In fact, there's been a number of articles about it. I guess it's finally budging a little bit, but here we are in this so-called full employment economy, and yet wages haven't significantly risen until maybe recently. Maybe they finally are a little bit, because employers didn't want to give. They, you know, well, and now they're having to, the idea was if it's a seller's market, if there's a million people out there, if there aren't a million people looking for a job, then you're going to have to pay to get better talent, and they're still resisting that idea.
Well, it's the easy thing to do is to keep things status quo.
Right.
And I've seen it gone into companies where they haven't raised their rates for 5-7 years.
Wow.
They haven't raised their rates that they're asking for their customers. So naturally, they're not going to want to raise their rates to what they're paying. There nowadays, if you don't increase your rates every year, it's really hard to make it up.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think I need to raise my rates here on the radio station. I think that's what we need to do immediately.
Well,
you know,
it gets to that thing. Is it we're getting this economic vice where the Federal Reserve has said we want to raise the cost of living, because that's what inflation is.
Right.
Is the cost, we want to raise it at least 2% a year.
Yes.
At least.
They think that's healthy. 2% is healthy.
I've heard the argument, I don't remember why. But they're excluding things like housing and cost of energy. Well, that doesn't count. Really? That doesn't count. So the Fed said, look, we're going to raise the price, what everything costs. And it's this economic vice is getting tighter.
Well, because they want to slow things down, I think. You know, they want to keep it at a certain pace. Somehow they think 2% is manageable. If it gets to 10% or too fast growth gets out of hand, and too slow a growth starts to stumble and we go backwards. So they've got this kind of, you know, right in the middle approach. I don't understand Goldilocks economy, exactly. Uh-huh. And I'm not sure I completely understand the logic of it, but that's what I've heard over and over again. And I sometimes think in my cynical ways, they need to raise rates so that when the next crisis or stumble comes along, and there always seems to be one, we always hope there's never another one, but there always is, that when it comes, they have something to do, because that's the only thing that the Fed can do is cut rates or print money. They only have two weapons.
They can buy bonds.
Yeah, I suppose
the last crisis said they can do anything they want.
They can do anything they want.
I mean, you got central banks. The Fed doesn't admit, but there are other central banks, the Swiss central bank, they buy stocks. They've bought Facebook stock.
Yeah. Really? Wow. I didn't
know
that.
They can do anything they want. They're basically you know, they do everything except wear robes, you know. No, you have all this guidance.
Wow, and
can
okay.
Do
don't be cynical. So, I guess I'm just saying they only have a certain number of limited tools, though. And so if they've used them all up, then a crisis comes along, they got nowhere to go to. So they try and, I think they try and build up some cushions so they can come back down again to ease, to make us suddenly go, oh, okay, everything's better.
So they reduce the amount of heroin for a little while. And then, right when it gets really painful, hey, now we can give you more.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of the same thing. Kind of the same thing. Hey, we got to do something. We got to intrude in this conversation. We got to be capitalists and tell people about sponsors of this program here. And then let's come back and get into the main topic of full employment and what that means for the new economy here right after this. All right, and guess what? We want to remind you that as a business leader, you are bombarded with concepts and ideas and information to improve your business, everything we're talking about. But what order should you implement them? I don't know. They all come at me so fast and so furiously, I'm not sure even how to sort through them or think through them, much less put them in some sensible order. Well, for those who seek order in the world, there is a book, Alex's book, where Transforming Your Company, which can liberate you and your company from dysfunction. How? Well, let's start by transforming your company and how you think. The book provides a sequence for applying the great ideas so you don't waste time sitting there with all the blocks on the table trying to arrange them in the right order here. The book also explains the fatal assumption that business improvement concepts make so you can avoid wasting your time and money if this one hidden condition exists in your company. That sounds tempting. I'm going to have to read the book to find that one. It is available on Amazon and Audible.com. You can listen to it. You can read it. And the first five people to request a copy on Hey Vorobyev button. That's right. You can go to the Hey Vorobyev button on ConfidentROI.com. We'll get a free copy. And that goes on. So, you know, maybe only two respond today. Don't give up because you heard it a month from now. Go to ConfidentROI.com and hit that Hey Vorobyev button. I want my free copy of Transform Your Company. Okay, tried to make that not as intrusive as we could here, but back to Alex and full employment. Full employment, what does, you know, they used to say full employment was really some unemployment. I mean, it's not really 100% because there's always people coming into the job force, going out of the job force, people that just won't get a job, can't get a job, whatever. I mean, it's not full employment. Full employment is a myth, right?
Full employment is who wants a job? And so that's where you get, there's two unemployment rates the Fed follows. And one, and the headline one is how many people who either are working or want a job are employed. And I guess it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And then there's they have the U5 or U6, which tracks what percentage of people in employment age are working. And that's been going down as a percentage over time. And it's actually got the economists worried because the percentage of people working has been declining.
Yes.
And they try to say, oh, it's because the retirement people. Well, no, if you look at people above retirement age, their actual employment rates have been going up. That's kind of, they've actually gone back to work.
Either because they want to or because they have to. Right.
Yeah. And so it's
because I read that in the journal the other day, the Wall Street Journal, and they were saying, you know, yes, everybody, happy days are here at last. Full employment, you know, hasn't happened in 50 years or something here. Wow. You know, it's going to go on and on forever. And in that, they tried to say, well, again, you know, full employment doesn't mean 100% of people are working. 100%, you know, maybe, like you said, people who want to work. And that's what's changing. There is a perception that as we are retiring, as the baby boom is retiring at record numbers every day, that's part of what's keeping this number high, is that fewer and fewer people want to work or are willing to work or are able to work as they retire and get older. so that with the labor force is shrinking, and therefore that juices the number and makes it seem like employment's up because the pool is down. Does that make sense?
People are doing their analysis, if it's even in their head, is it worth it for them to work? And things are changing now. Is it worth it for me to drive that distance?
Yeah.
And to deal with that. I had a young guy in Chicago. Once he explained to me why you couldn't get people to work at $20 an hour, because for them to give up the benefits they got in Chicago, they would really need more than $50,000 guaranteed. And that was like $50,000. Well, I'd live that way the same way now.
Through like welfare and other things?
In terms of help with rent, you're getting rent, food, and different types of benefits, end quote. That was where at least the break-even point was. And that was like, okay, not doing anything or doing something. Now, that's not everywhere in the economy, but it's out there that it's economics.
Right.
Does it make sense to get up and drive and do that? And I think more and more people are questioning that.
And I'll go one step further. I've never read this, so maybe I'm totally out of whack. Write in and hit the Hey Verobia button and say, hey, tell this guy he's nuts. But I also think that more and more people are going into the so-called underground economy. You know, the firemen who retired, supposedly, but it's working side jobs. The people who are working Uber or other sorts of things, you know, the gig economy and doing other things. And I think there are other ways other than, you know, whether they report their taxes or not, I don't know. But they're not necessarily reporting a job. They're not going to someplace. They're not either in, they're creatively finding ways to make money that I don't know register in the so-called employment report.
Well, if you're not seeking employment and going to the unemployment department and that and registering, you're looking, you really drop off of the unemployment rate.
Exactly.
Now, are you fully employed? If you're working on Fiverr and you're doing things, are you fully employed? Are you
partially employed?
They try to make estimates on, okay, how many self-employed people are out there, and it's a new world with how people can make money.
Yeah,
they can have side hustles and and do different things now.
Exactly.
If they end up getting paid through a transaction through a bank, that's going to eventually show up. That eventually they're going to get a 1099.
So again, we're all measuring in old world measurements where people who wanted a job, who are seeking a job, somehow registered and showed up, and we measured how many and whether the unemployment claims are going up or the unemployment claims are going down, whether more people are at the unemployment offices or less people are at the unemployment offices.
Yeah, and you can't go to the unemployment office if you've been working for yourself.
No.
You're self-employed. You can't go there.
I've always been self-employed, and that's one of the downsides. I can't file for disability. I can't workman's comp.
But you do get the opportunity to pay for
because I'm generous. I like that. I just think that we, again, like so many things, so we've all made a happy assumption that we're in full employment, and maybe we are. I'm not trying to be negative here. But there are other – what does that really measure? Does that measure – full pay? I mean, are people just taking lesser work? Are they settling for less? Are they doing more on the side? Are they retiring and shrinking the pool of people? There's a lot of other factors that go into it. I mean, it's not just, gee, employment's full, employment's up, employment's down. I think it's much more complicated than that.
What I see is, what it crystallized for me was at a CEO roundtable about a year ago.
Right.
And they went around the table and they're talking about their businesses. And each one of them mentioned in some way a real issue with supply of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were different. And they were all different industries, from unskilled to skilled, highly educated. But they were all having challenges. And they didn't realize it. And ever since then, I've been looking and watching, and it's out there. I've been looking for areas where there's plenty of labor supply, and somebody said, it might have been on the show, that, oh no, down in San Diego, there's plenty of commercial tile layers there. So if anyone knows of any other areas with excess labor, put it on the Hey Verobia button.
I'll tell you another one that I've seen. We used to do a show on manufacturing in the station here, and so we would have the Institute for Supply Management, the big group that with the Labor Department tracks all this stuff and helps explain it. And they had their chief economist on every time this report came out, the labor report and the manufacturing reports, and what's up, what's down. And one of the things he said, too, this has been going on for quite a while, this is before we were in full employment even, is that the so-called skilled trades, to be a CAD operator, to be an HVAC technician, to do air conditioning installation, something beyond unskilled labor, those jobs have been aging and finding it difficult to attract young people. No parent says, gee, I want you to grow up and be a plumber. I want you to grow up and be an HVAC guy. I want you to be a CAD operator. We want no skilled trades anymore. We want everybody to go to college and come out with a French degree, and then somehow that's going to lead to six figures. And many of these jobs can pay six figures. They're very well, but they're not sexy. They're manual still. They're intensive. I had a friend of mine who had a construction company, and he said in the summer he used to get kids, typically the jocks, who would come out work the construction jobs for summer. He said they don't want to work that hard anymore. That was his feeling. They don't want to put that kind of manual labor in. And so there have been sectors of the economy, even when people were crying for jobs, that were going without applicants because they didn't fit what we want to do anymore. Which I think, and I don't want to start a debate on immigration, but I think that's, again, where a lot of immigration has historically filled those kinds of jobs. And as we limit immigration...
In Southern California, Paul.
Yeah, well, I think everywhere. Don't you think, everywhere? Don't you think those are the people that came in and did the labor jobs and stuff and everything?
Not necessarily in Idaho. I think Southern California has had, in different areas, have had access to that kind of labor, but not everywhere.
It's just that our kids don't want to do that work anymore. My kid doesn't want to be work in a sweaty environment, no matter how much you pay.
So they've been convinced, everyone's been brainwashed, they need to stay in school longer and take on massive amounts of unforgivable debt.
Yeah. Student debt has tripled, I just saw on the New York Times piece. It's gone from like $600 billion to $1.8 trillion or something like that.
I was just talking with a dentist, and kids coming out of dental school are coming out with $500,000 in debt.
And I heard somebody else, we had a doctor in here the other day, a young doctor, and he said, that's why I can't go into my own practice. I have to pay this off. I've got to come out and immediately start making money. Even if I could make more money, I can't take the risk and open up my office and do all the other stuff. I got to pay off this debt first.
Well, but they do have the economic trade-off in terms of, in California, they'll make $90,000 out of school.
Right.
But right now in Oklahoma, you can go and start at $250,000.
If you're willing to go to
Oklahoma. It's an economic trade-off in terms of where you want to start. I'm seeing it in physical therapy. These kids come out with about $100,000 in debt, and they want to make money to pay off their debt. And
which is why here in Southern California, we were also having the other unintended consequence was they're deferring family formation and deferring buying a house. They're living with mom and dad longer to help pay down that debt. And that's slowing down. Well, we are supposed to be a supply of people buying new houses and all the toys that go with it. And instead, they're putting that off until they pay down the debt.
But that's economically rational.
Right.
And that's the
solution. But it's disruptive.
Really, is to let the economics play out. I mean, one of the things that's preventing more supply of labor is the minimum wage. Because when I first started working as a kid, I didn't justify $3.35 an hour. I work for free range balls at the Ridgeline Golf Course.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the greatest thing ever. I get free range balls? Wow.
I worked $3. For 90 cents an hour at Stroh's Ice Cream Parlor. That was my first job at 15.
But I had to prove myself I had to prove to them I was worth $3.35 an hour.
Yeah.
And that was the greatest thing ever when I was there. But when you say there's a minimum wage, most times that basically says you cannot work for less. You can't prove yourself because people will hire if they can get a return on their investment.
Yeah.
But if they can't, then it comes to, do they have to change their business model? And there's a couple articles here that the big companies are. And actually Accenture, the big consulting firm. Uh-huh. They think one of the top 2,000 biggest companies will, in the next few years, will be have no employees outside of the C-suite.
There is the most frightening figure, and I don't hear anybody left or right talking about this. The number of companies, mine to a certain degree included, we're trying to do this without employees. We're trying to, you know, when Airbnb is worth much more than Marriott Hotels, how many people does Marriott Hotels employ? And yet Airbnb, which is ostensibly their competitor, has a mere fraction of those employees and is worth some big multiple. Where I'd love to talk about that more, because I think we're going to try and create employee-less companies if we're not already.
But it's economics. How can you add a value? How can you provide a value proposition that the customer wants to buy, and you can afford to pay the employees what you can afford?
Yeah.
And also give them a reason to work for you.
And it's the one cost. I mean, that's why everybody offshored things. They were trying to reduce the one cost it can control, which is labor. And now through robots, you can eliminate it. You have a sizable upfront investment and some maintenance to keep the thing alive and a handful of people fixing the robots. But basically, you're eliminating all the sick time and overtime and all the other stuff that goes with having an employee.
Well, but there's also there's a change in the unskilled portion. There's an article in The Atlantic about what full employment means. And the guy's got a couple made-from-scratch pizza orders. He said before, there was always a pile of applications, and I mm-hmm. could find people to work. Now, there's no pile. But so now he's competing on vacation time, on flexible hours.
Right.
And so he's having to compete in different ways. Some stores are closing down on certain days of the week. I know I was up in Sun Valley this summer, and the store was closed, and they had a sign like, we're closed today because of lack of labor.
Really? I've never seen that before.
The Fed mentioned it in their beige book that came out for the third quarter. But it's happening more and more. There was a Wall Street Journal article about how in Indiana, where they make all the RVs for the baby boomers, uh-huh. they can't get employees for the restaurants, so they close a couple days of the week. So they've either made that economic calculation of, okay, we should close down or pay more, and determine it makes sense to close down days than to pay more.
Yeah, so there's only so many customers coming in on a Monday, so we'll trade that revenue off. Well, but again, so we've got two different trends that we're talking about here. One is full employment. Everybody can get a job but wants a job, and that's going to drive labor costs up. You're going to have to pay more, give more to get the good ones. And then on the other hand, you've got technology wiping out jobs left and right, particularly the unskilled jobs. I don't care how, we could debate this endlessly, but I don't care how many tariffs we put back up and other things. I don't know that Chrysler is ever going to start paying people $100,000 to put wheels on tires like they used to a million years ago when my relatives worked back there. I think more and more they're going to automate these. They're going to automate trucks. They're automating fry cooks. They're automating everything they can think of.
Hey, Tesla tried to do that, and there's a great article about how people within Tesla went behind Elon and implemented. They had to get people to do certain number of jobs, and that his goal of automating the entire line just wasn't realistic. Mm-hmm. And so it's not so much not just the financial compensation, but now that employers are forced to think about their emotional compensation. Why does someone want to work for you? Why do they want to keep coming in?
Let's delve into that one. Let's take one more break and delve, because that's a big one. We do a lot about EQ. You got to suddenly worry about how they feel and what their emotions are, and you can't treat them like robots anymore here. So all of that and more as we come back with this free-ranging discussion here on Confident ROI this morning. All right, let's go back and see if I can find the right ad here, because we want to tout the latest issue of Confident ROI magazine. There is a magazine that supports us. You know, you can continue this conversation at your leisure. You can grab a copy, and wherever you sit and read, curl up in that chaise lounge or that hammock outside, and at your pace, pick through the interesting brain thoughts that we discover here in this show and in this conversation stream. So, articles this week, Google's discovery to improve effectiveness of teams. Okay, maybe we'll talk about that. And tribal leadership, isn't that the word of the day, tribal? How to win the war for talent, how to make people want to be part of your team and your tribe. And an article from Jack Daly on how to incentivize your sales team and much more. Sign up for the print digital audio version now at confidentroi.com. Don't just listen, read. Wish I could make that a mantra for my kid here. You know, just don't just listen, read. Well, all right, so emotional. When I was a youngster starting off, you talk about being able to prove yourself. One of the ways you proved yourself is you just shut up and did the work. You didn't worry about, nobody ever asked me if I was happy at Stroh's Ice Cream. Nobody ever asked me if I was happy my first radio job. Everybody just said, you're lucky to have a job, get in there and do this, and shut up. And now it's like, are you happy? How do you feel today? Let's massage you. I'm being cynical and sound like an old guy here, but talk about this. You say we gotta entice you to be part of our team, and we gotta keep motivating and keeping excited more than paying you.
Let's how people were raised change. You know, we were raised where if you wanted some money, go earn it.
Yeah.
Our parents just weren't going to give it to us, and they weren't going to tell us how great we were.
No.
We have to go prove that we were worthy of praise and love.
Yeah. And I didn't get any praise and love, you know, from them or from my employers. It was like, you're just, you got a job, didn't you? I paid you, didn't I? Now shut up and go back to work.
Thanks to the baby boomers, things have changed, but that's just the reality. And one of the articles he had in the new issue of Confident ROI is on the book Tribal Leadership, which talks about how can you win the war on talent. And one of the ways you're winning is if you can get the best talent at a slight discount.
They're willing to work for you less than they would somewhere else.
They want to come work for you for less. We also have an article on this engineering company in there that's growing quite quickly, and how they're attracting talent and attracting them from blue chip companies, and they're attracting them. It's not just the financial compensation. Sometimes it's equal or less, but oftentimes they're appealing to the noble cause that there's a reason you're doing this, or, hey, this is just a great group to be involved with.
Right.
There's no shortage of dysfunctional companies, tribes, departments, but to come work for one where they aren't sucking the life out of you.
Yeah.
That is worth something.
Yeah. How do you create that, though? And I'll give you a perfect example. This is an old school example, but again, years and years ago, I happened to work with an older gentleman, a partner who when we did PR, who handled Marriott Hotels and knew Bill Marriott himself and how he traveled around the country anonymously to check on things. And I stayed at a Marriott a couple times during that period, and I was amazed. One was at the Orange County Convention Center. I came down one year to go to a convention. I stayed at the Hilton. Nah, everything went wrong. The card wouldn't work. The people were late. The reservation was screwed up, and nobody said anything. Next year, I stayed at the Marriott, and I got there late. And not only did everything work, but I went down to the pool because I wanted to get in a hot tub or something because I was stressed and ready. And I go down, typical California response, I'm going to go in the hot tub. And I go down there, and it's just closing, and there's no towels. And I thought, great. And there's some little hourly employee walking around cleaning up around the area. And he saw me, and he saw my frustration, and he walks over and he says, can I get you a towel, sir? And I thought, no, nobody's around. He could just as easily have split. His shift is at the end. Nobody's going to know whether or not he's nice to me, but he did. So what's the difference? Why was that? And that was seemed to be the Marriott culture, that that was a reputation and what I lived. They seemed to care. I don't know if they still do, but they did at one time. And that was instilled by Bill Marriott and the people who ran that company.
Well, it didn't happen by accident.
No, that's for sure.
And people think that the times of, hey, people are happy for a job, that's great. But a lot of companies have realized early on that we got to give a reason people want to work for us. and give them a reason to give the service we want to give. And, hey, this is the type of service and things you got to do to stay within our group. But it also means, hey, steady employment. If we do this right, we can compete. We can excel. You can grow. And oftentimes that's the companies focus more, and smaller companies focus more on the sales. But now that they realize, look, you don't have just one sales front anymore. Now yeah. You also have, you got to sell employees on why they should come work for you and why they should stay working for you.
That's what you're talking about, the sales front. It's not just selling the customer anymore. You got to sell your employees. You got to sell your vendors to work with you. You got to sell.
More and more companies are running up against their bottleneck is no longer how many customers they can add and it's slowing the growth of the company. The bottleneck is now qualified, competent people who can do the work. But that takes a strategy and some thought in answering important questions ahead of time.
We've all seen the video, or many of us have, Simon Sinek. He's made a famous career out of this. You know, find your why. That's why customers want you. They don't want to just buy a product. They want to be part of a mission to change the world and buy into your why, what you're trying to accomplish here, and support that. Certainly, crowdfunding's all about that. Hey, I'm starting a little company. Can you give me some money and I'll give you a free t-shirt because you want to be part of this revolution? How do you get people to buy into the tribe, into the revolution? How do you get people to care? I don't know how one group gets people to care and the other group, they could care less. And I see more and more of the care lesses these days, particularly in service. You know, they don't care whether or not you're... I'll give you a perfect example. This is a story I've told a million times. Years ago, I was an American Express customer for 20 years. I thought it was so cool to get an American Express card. I kept it even though it cost me money and I didn't, got less. But I pulled it out and I felt cool, right? Their brand was cool to me and impressive. And one day I had some little debate over some charge and I got mad as I called them on the phone. I said, you know, I should just cancel this card. And the woman says, I can do that for you. I said, that's all I mean to you? Yeah, go ahead and cancel it. And I've never gotten one again. It meant nothing to her whether I stayed with them for 20 years. And I was crushed. So I think there are many people that feel the same way, that just don't, particularly in this world where we're all segmented. She's probably sitting in India or someplace, or Philippines, or in Iowa for all I know. Wherever she is, she has no connection with that company and could care less whether I stay a customer.
Well, now though, when you want to cancel your card, like, well, you're going to get the whole spiel, and then you got to talk to the supervisor, right?
Yes, well, that's
and
true.
And they'll try to talk out of it, reduce the fees.
Too.
Because, you know, they're going to get, it's going to go against them because they have a cancellation. So how do you get people bought into the culture? And it's got to be alive. I mean, Wells Fargo, they've gone the opposite. They'll give you an account if you don't want it or not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
But that's... The leadership wasn't living the values, and the values were pasted on the walls, but their behavior and what they wanted done was in conflict with that.
I go back to my core question. So I'm running a company, whether it's a manufacturing or a restaurant or something. How do you get your people, especially your minimum wage people, to care?
Exactly. And so and many times people never answer that question.
I don't know how to answer that question.
How do you get them to care? And some companies can, but you also got to give what's in it for them.
Yeah.
And it's not just financial, it's emotional. Is it helping them take that next step up the ladder? Because a lot of times the implied thing is, look, you can work here. Hopefully we can work here as long as possible. But what's the future?
Yeah.
If you're saying, then look, you're just going to be in a dead end here, then you're kind of setting them up for not to care. But how do you, if you care about them, will they care about you?
Somewhere I read an article a while ago about, had something to do with somebody that made some part for a rocket, you know, one of the Atlas rocket or something, and sub vendor. And they did interviewed about some of the people on the line that were making this part. They didn't even know what the part did, but the part went into a rocket, right? And they said something to one of these people, like, how do you like working here? What do you do for a living? And the person didn't say, I don't know, yeah. I just move parts. He said, yep. I make rockets. Maybe that story was from you. But
I think one of our guests in NASA, and you know, the president asked, and I get people to the moon.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
I get people, so that guy cared. He's doing something. He's not even sure what it is, but he knows he's part of a chain and a team, and it felt important to him. I get people to the moon. I'm part of this. I put that bolt in, and if not for me, this rocket ship wouldn't make it to the moon. That's caring. That's amazing.
And it doesn't have to be the moon, but it can also be, hey, we help the people in our company live a good life, you know, by helping our customers.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be you know, some
giant
shoes on everybody in the third world.
Right.
Like some of these things are, but
it doesn't have to be noble, but feel good.
It doesn't have to be noble, but it can be, you know, the survival of our tribe in a healthy manner, sustainable manner, from a moral standpoint. That is a cause that appeals to our internal wiring.
How do you get people to feel pride in work anymore, particularly as they are more and more it's more complex, so they're not sure what their role is anymore. I just do this little thing, and it's hard for me to see how it fits all under the big pattern. Or they're distant from the main mothership. I'm just a sub vendor somewhere here doing this somewhere. I don't feel any connection to the corporation and the culture and the people. I don't get the pep talk or see the big vision. Or it's just, you know, you just feel like a cog in a machine. I don't know. How do you get people?
That's the question that all companies often it's easy not to address that question.
Yes, right.
But if you address it, like, why is the person in this department, you know, that can easily be forgotten about, why are they going to care?
Right.
Is it, you know, you see in things where inspected by the person's name.
Yeah, right.
You know, that, hey, your name's on this.
Right.
And there is more acknowledgement. People like it when they get acknowledgement in the mail, their home mail. Like, hey, you did a great job. And their family gets to know. People want to know these things. I mean, it appeals to our natural wiring to be recognized for our contribution to the tribe.
Right. And I don't know if this is, again, I'm going to sound like an old guy again here, but my father's generation and my generation, to a certain degree, we took pride in just doing something. Whether anybody knew it or not, I did that.
I liked the way it looked.
Yeah.
And there was a feeling of pride there, but our neurotransmitters, you know, we get dopamine from Facebook and all this, but how do we get the right neurotransmitters making us feel good from the work we're doing? And that is a conscious choice, that an emotional compensation that a company is like, how are we going to get them to fire the right to release the right neurotransmitters to make them feel good about the work we're going to do?
Yeah. What did you call that?
Emotional compensation.
Right. It's not just enough to give them monetary compensation. You got to figure out, if you want to go deeper and get them to care, you got to get emotional compensation.
And the default way is there's emotional tax. When you leave the day and you're drained emotionally, yeah, you just got taxed. And what do we like to do with taxes?
Avoid them.
people of a certain party.
Ouch.
I'm not a member of any party.
Yeah,
by the way, you can always pay more tax. No one's ever gone to jail for that. All taxes theft. But emotional compensation or emotional taxes, people now are I think that's one of the reasons they're having trouble filling roles, is there's an emotional tax in these roles.
Mm. It's stressful. It's draining. It's difficult. And no matter what I pay you, I don't want to do
it. People are voting. It's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity to change business models, to tweak things, to offer emotional compensation. There's every challenge is an opportunity.
Well, if you don't have an emotional compensation plan, there's a man who can help you. Alex Vorobyev, we thank you for talking with us today here. How do they reach you if they want to find out more about the consulting work you do and want to indulge in some of these mind-growing exercises here?
Well, I'm no longer taking on consulting clients.
We can convince you.
No, I'm now investing in purchasing businesses and applying what I've learned. But you can always reach out to me at theconfidentroi.com, the Hey Vorobyev button. But I'm applying the things that I've learned over the decades and fixing other companies. And I'm applying them to my own businesses now.
I think that makes sense. Well, I look forward to the books and the results of that as you put into practice your own preaching. And we'll find out more as this
preaching.
Well, you know.
Time to pass the hat, man.
Time to pass the hat. Thank you for your thoughts and ideas and for continuing this conversation. I don't know where else you'd get this sort of free-ranging examination of the big picture here, except on confident ROI.
Hopefully it wasn't an emotional tax on the listener.
Hopefully not here. All right. You've been listening to the one show that gives you a real return on your investment. Put a little time into it. You're going to grow. Your brain's going to get bigger. We're going to help you reboot the system that came with the initial hardware. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.